For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Books Studios. I'm your host, Red Sail, and today we're putting three of the greatest contemporary spy writers under the spotlight. Dame Stella Rimington reveals that she still keeps a sharp eye out for espionage, despite retiring as chief of MI5.
My research consists really of just trying to keep in touch with what's going on and imagining what's probably going on behind the scenes.
Frederick Forsyth and Frank Gardner go head-to-head in Cheltenham and spill the beans about how close fact comes to fiction.
I know a lot of people think, public school, speaks Arabic, come on, former banker, he's bound to be a spook. I'd have made a rubbish spook because I want to tell, like Freddie, I'm a storyteller. You want to tell people stories.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Dame Stella Rimington came to prominence in 1992 when she was revealed as the first female Director General of MI5. Both her gender and the revelation of her identity were unprecedented. Since her retirement in 1996, she's written both an autobiography and a highly successful series of novels, starring MI5 agent Liz Carlyle. The 10th book, The Moscow Sleepers, is out now, and Dame Stella Rimington joined me down the line to tell me more. Dame Stella Rimington, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So the new book, The Moscow Sleepers, is the 10th in the series. For those who haven't yet read it, could you set the scene?
When I'm thinking about plots for my books, I keep a pretty sharp eye on what's going on, particularly in the world of security. And as I was working this one out, which was probably, I suppose, about 2 years ago now, when I first started thinking of the plot, it occurred to me that there were two things sort of happening in the world. And one was that the Russians were, I wouldn't say that we had gone back into a second Cold War, but that the Russians were still trying to undermine the West. So I thought that that was part of the plot. And the second bit of the plot was sort of concerns about cyber espionage, the use of the internet for fake news and all that sort of thing. So those were the two things I thought about. And the third one, I suppose, was that the big refugee crisis was going on at that time. Masses of refugees were coming across into Europe and particularly into Germany. So those were the sort of elements that I put together to make a plot which became quite complicated, as anybody who reads the book.
I know, obviously, you've left the service. Is your research purely observational now, or do you still have friends and contacts in the service who will help you with plot points?
No, not really. I mean, in the secret world, you're either inside the ring of secrecy or you're outside. And if you're outside, you're not being fed with information from inside. You're really kind of yesterday's person. So my research consists really of just trying to keep in touch with what's going on and imagining what's probably going on behind the scenes. So I use my experience, obviously, of the time that I was in the service through quite a long period to imagine the sort of investigations that the intelligence services might be making of the kind of situations that you read in the newspapers are actually going on.
And you mentioned that the Russians are still meddling with Western affairs. Your service spanned the Cold War. It presumably didn't come as a surprise to you that in the Putin era, that meddling has come to the fore again.
No, it didn't surprise me in the least. You're right. I began my time in MI5 really when the Cold War was at its height. I joined the service in the late 1960s. And the fact that the place I joined it, which was in India, was one of the forefronts of the Cold War. So my very, very early experience of the service, when I was really only a part-time clerk typist, was of espionage going on. India at that time was absolutely full of spies of all kinds as the East and the West fought for influence in India. So that was the beginning of my time in the service. And then as time went on, I worked more and more in our counter-espionage area. So I was dealing with with Soviet, as it was then, efforts at espionage in Britain, particularly, and in Europe, where they were trying to gather secrets, recruit people to give them secret information that would help them, I suppose, if the Cold War had ever turned to a fighting war.
And I know that you were born just before the Second World War broke out and spent a fair amount of your childhood sheltering in bomb shelters. And I read somewhere that you used to say that you wanted to be a fighter pilot. Was that sense of protecting national security something deeply ingrained in you from an early age?
Well, I didn't have any sort of coherent ambition to join the intelligence services or to do anything like that. But I suppose my early childhood gave me a real sense of danger, you know, because certainly we lived always in areas where there was bombing, because my father worked in the iron and steel business. So inevitably we were in places, first of all, really in London, where I was born. But then we moved up to Barrow-in-Furness in Lancashire, which was where the Vickers shipyard was. So that was an area for bombing. So I sat in an air raid shelter for night after night listening to bombs. And I suppose that did give me a real sense that there was danger. And that I suppose from that came a feeling that I would like to do something to try and protect against danger. But it was all quite by chance, actually, that I ever found myself in the intelligence services in MI5, because in those days nobody knew how you joined and you had to wait really to be tapped on the shoulder, which is what happened to me.
You, as you say, joined in India, and that was a part-time job, and you returned and then applied to join the service full-time in the UK.
Yes, I was in India as a diplomat's wife. My husband had been posted to the British High Commission in New Delhi. And I'd given up my first job, which was as a historical archivist. That was going to be my profession. But in those days, of course, women sort of followed their man. So when he was posted to India, I gave up work and went with him to be a diplomat's wife. And I found that that wasn't a frightfully satisfying career, because in those days, as a diplomat's wife, you weren't allowed to work at anything outside. So I spent my time running coffee mornings and jumble sales and things. And then somebody tapped me on the shoulder, effectively, which is the way in those days he joined the intelligence services, and offered me a job. But the job was as a part-time clerk typist, so it wasn't anything very elevated. But it did introduce me to the world of the intelligence services. And so when we came back to London, instead of going back to being an archivist, I decided I would join the intelligence services. And I was accepted into MI5 as a full-time officer.
Your 30-year-old self probably would never have believed that you would have ended up becoming Director General.
Absolutely not, because in those days it was very much a man's world. The men did the sort of sharp-end work, and the women, and there was in fact a women's grade. It didn't much matter whether, like me, you had a degree or a previous career or whatever. If you were a woman, you joined what was known as the assistant officer grade, and the men were the officers, and the men did the sharp-end intelligence work, and the women sort of stayed at home and helped and dealt with the papers and did a bit of research if they were thought to be quite bright and things like that. But it was very much a two-tier world in those days. It's the early 1970s. It wasn't until, you know, getting on into the 70s with women's lib and sex discrimination legislation and such like, that the women in the service started to effectively revolt and say, you know, hang on, why are we second-class people? We think we could do the job just as well as the men. And in the end, of course, they gave some of us a try, and that's where the women actually broke through and are now, of course, working in all areas of the intelligence world and doing a very good job indeed.
And you certainly portray that very effectively through Liz Carlisle, who is an agent first, but very much a female agent, a woman who has family concerns and whether she's got anything left in the fridge to eat at the end of the day, very much at the forefront of her mind whilst doing her job, in a way that you just don't get with male writers and male characters.
Yes, I suppose Liz Carlisle actually reflects a lot of aspects of my life, actually. I mean, she's a modern MI5 officer, as you've said. I mean, she's doing all the work of the service. She runs sources, human sources. She directs operations. She's out there on the front line. But she's a woman. And so I like to, you know, sort of include with her some of the aspects of the life I led when I was a mother of two small children. I was running human sources and doing operations, and it wasn't very easy. And so I like to include some of that in Liz. You know, she finds balancing her work and her private life always very difficult, as did I, really. And I think, as you say, men don't do that. Well, they don't have that experience, actually, do they? I mean, male writers of spy stories tend to go for the action, whereas I think in my writing, I like to go for the sort of personal experience side of things and not so much of the rushing about and shooting people and such like, which you often read about, which is not at all realistic, I have to say, in some of the espionage writing.
To the outsider, to the reader, it seems far more plausible. You call it the subtle psychological game of agent running, which to me seems far more likely than having characters like they have in Spooks running around shooting people on the streets of London, which
is totally unrealistic. But, I mean, to begin with, British intelligence is not licensed to kill, whatever James Bond might say. So nobody's rushing around shooting people on the street, or if they are, it's the police or the military, but certainly not the intelligence services. I suppose the thing I objected to most with Spooks was that every week just a handful of people sort of saved the world from some hideous thing, whereas in fact, particularly in MI5, everything really is a team effort. You know, there are experts in surveillance, in following people around. There are experts in radio interception, there are experts in analysis, etc., etc. And any operation is a combination of many different skills. It's not about any individual. And I hope I portray that in the books, actually, that although Liz Carlyle is up front in many of the situations she's in, there is behind her a team of other people who are backing her up and doing the analysis and working out what it all means and, you know, getting support and clearance for operations and such like. It's a much, much more complicated world than some of the writers would have you believe.
One thing that you do share with many of the male writers is that tension that seems to exist between MI5 and MI6, which is definitely played out between Charles Weatherby, the head of MI5 in your books, and Geoffrey Fane, the head of MI6. Is that something that happens in real life?
Not nowadays, it isn't, no. That's slightly pulling the leg of the people I knew. Because when I first joined, there was, I think, a tension, really, between the two services. They have two very different jobs to do. I mean, MI5 is our defence service. Their job is to protect the country against serious threats. And they work very closely with the police, etc. MI6's job is to gather intelligence, often, nearly always, actually, from abroad. And they work in a very different way. And when I first joined, that difference was a lot more obvious than it is now, I think. And so I suppose I just have a bit of fun, really, recreating characters that were rather like some of the characters I knew in my early days. I know very well that sort of tension no longer exists. They're now working extremely closely together in teams with the police as well, in joint assessment groups, etc. So that's slightly historical, but I like doing it because I like creating characters who amuse and entertain me as well as I hope, the readers.
Another trope of espionage fiction is the mole, and in the Moscow Sleepers there are dormant agents who might be reactivated as well. Is the preoccupation with moles and traitors something that British spy writers have far more at their core than their foreign counterparts?
The recruiting of sources of information is very much, even nowadays in today's technological world, is very important a part of intelligence gathering, what you are trying to do and what Liz Carlisle tries to do, and this is real, is get sort people who are within the organization or the whatever it is that they're fighting or worried about, to try and tell them what's going on. It's known in the professional world as agent running, and the whole point is to recruit people who will stay where they are and give you a stream of intelligence from inside. So that's quite a real thing. It's not unique, obviously, to British intelligence. I mean, all intelligence services try to do it, the Russians in particular. And that's one of the things about the Moscow sleepers, is that I have two long-standing recruited sources of the KGB, or its modern version, the FSB, who are sitting there in the sense, well, one of them's waiting to be activated and one of them is already activated. So, yeah, I mean, that's quite a sort of realistic, I think, a realistic scenario.
Do you think British spy writers are more preoccupied with the betrayal side because perhaps the likes of Kim Philby and Anthony Blunt and so on and so forth in past have embarrassed MI5 and MI6? Or do you think the Russian spy writers and German spy writers are equally paranoid about betrayal as well?
Certainly, when I first joined MI5, which was, as I said, really at the beginning of the 1970s, the sense of betrayal that was a hangover from the Cambridge spies was still there. It was still palpable in the service I joined. There were people still working there who'd actually known Philby particularly, but also Guy Burgess and McLean in the Foreign Office. And they had a real personal sense of betrayal. And it kind of led to a feeling in the service of those long, long ago days that, you know, you couldn't really actually trust anybody. Nothing was possibly as it seemed. And it was this wonderful, wonderful to a novelist, sense of the sort of wilderness of mirrors, you know, what is true, what isn't. I find that absolutely fascinating theme, really. And I think most spy writers do. But maybe because of our history, although, I mean, every country's had its traitors, but because of our history and the sort of, I suppose, the drama of the Cambridge spies, I think maybe it does feature more in British writing, though I'm not an expert on other countries' spy writing.
And perhaps the fact that they did very much come from the establishment.
Well, it's that thing about, you know, people you know, people you know and people you trust and people you've been brought up with suddenly turn out to be something really very different from what you thought they were. And that is actually a fascinating theme for a novelist.
Yes, I suppose George Blake, who probably betrayed more people than anybody else, was seen as an outsider because he was a foreigner originally rather than Cambridge educated.
That's it, rather than a member of the establishment. Yes, that's true.
And do you read the opposition? Do you read John le Carré and Frederick Forsyth? And do you have a favourite amongst the other spy writers?
Well, John le Carré is certainly the master, in my opinion, particularly of the Cold War. I love his Cold War books. And again, it's partly because of what we've just been talking about, this wilderness of mirrors thing. You know, the sense that everybody's got two sides and you only know one side of them until something happens, when suddenly the other side is revealed. So I believe he creates, I think, very well that sense of, you know, this paranoid sense that I remember so well from the very beginning of my life in the service. So, yeah, he's my favourite. The other, I mean, I do read spy stories and such like, but I tend, and police things, I tend to read not the current ones, but the more, you know, the more classical ones, really. I love Dorothy Sayers, for example. I love the way she creates her characters. One of the things when I was starting out, I decided I wanted to do was something I learned from her, which was create a group of characters who recur over and over in the books in different groups, on one and sometimes on the other. And that's what she does. She has around Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Wimsey, there are the family members and the butler and all that stuff. And they come in all the books. And so I've got my characters around Liz Carlyle, Peggy Kinsolve, and her aide, Geoffrey Vane from MI6, Bruno Mackay, etc. And they come back and back into the books. And they're changing as the books move on. I mean, the Moscow Sleepers is the 10th, by which time everybody's grown up a bit from the days of the first book, At Risk, where they were all very young and spiky and argumentative. Now they're all much more mature, as am I, as time goes on.
And are you working on an 11th novel?
I'm working on one that isn't a Liz Carlyle, actually. Uh-huh. I decided that just for the moment, with the 10th, and Liz Carlyle seems to have found somebody that she's quite happy with, I thought I would just leave her there where she is for the moment and possibly come back to her later. But I'm working on something. It's still a spy story, but it's not a Liz Carlyle story. And it slightly goes back to, well, it goes back definitely to the Cold War and brings it into the modern era. It has a working title, which is The Devil's Bargain, but whether it will stick with that title, I'm not quite sure.
And we can expect it in a year or so?
Yes, probably next year, yes.
Finally, do you think Liz Carlyle will end up becoming Director General of MI5?
Well, that is the difficulty, quite frankly, because as the years go by, logically, Liz Carlyle should be getting more and more senior. But the trouble is, if she ends up as a very senior person, she's not going to be involved in operations. She's going to be involved in discussions with the Treasury about money and going over to the Home Office to talk to the Home Secretary. That's not going to be very exciting, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to freeze Liz Carlyle artificially at a certain age.
She's hit her glass ceiling.
She's certainly hit her age ceiling, I think.
Oh, well, Stella Rimmington, thank you so much for opening the Liz Carlyle file and letting me have a look inside.
Thank you very much.
The Moscow Sleepers is out now in paperback, ebook, and audio. Many of the other books in the Liz Carlyle series are available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, where you'll also find Stella Rimmington's autobiography, Open Secret. For a full list, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or check out the library website, rniblibrary.com. And Dame Stella Rimmington will be back at the end of the show to reveal the books of her life.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the Talking Books because Well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Frederick Forsyth and Frank Gardner are two of the best-informed writers in the world of espionage thrillers. Last year, for the first time, they appeared on the same stage at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. RNIB Connect Radio was there to record the event, which was chaired by Julia Wheeler.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very, very warm welcome to The Times and the Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival and indeed to this very special event. My name is Julia Wheeler and I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to the stage two authors who certainly know how to keep us turning the pages. Frederick Forsyth's first book, The Day of the Jackal, effectively defined the modern thriller genre with its fast pace and the crucial inside information that we've all come to love and to expect. He followed it with 13 novels, including The Odessa File, The Dogs of War, and The Fourth Protocol. His latest is The Fox, and it focuses on the most dangerous weapon in the world. As the BBC's security correspondent, Frank Gardner reports on national and international security. As a novelist, he takes us behind the scenes of British intelligence with MI6 agent Luke Carlton. During Carlton's first assignment, he was in Colombia for Frank's debut, Crisis, and that book was described by Freddie as fast, taut, tense, and accurate. For the ultimatum of his latest novel, Carlton is in a region which Frank has loved and been drawn to since his teens, the Middle East. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Frank and Frederick.
Thank you.
So, Frederick, let's begin with you. Tell us, what is this most dangerous weapon in the world?
Well, you might think it's something nuclear, but it isn't. We're now moving in a world that is so dominated by computers that just about every system is computer-dependent. And if you can destroy the computer systems, plural, of a country, presumably a hostile country, you can bring their entire economy, their entire society, to a halt. And that means a lot of life loss. You don't think it, but it does. If none of your hospitals work, there are going to be a lot of deaths. If your roads are utter and complete chaos, there are going to be a lot of deaths. If your weapon systems malfunction and self-detonate when they're not supposed to, that can cause a lot of death. In other words, we don't need anymore the B-52 of the Strategic Air Command with a hydrogen bomb on board to cause utter devastation. We can do it in cyberspace. And this particular weapon isn't even a piece of machinery. It's an 18-year-old boy with a bizarre mind that can penetrate the most secret databases in the world. And nobody knows how he does it. They simply have to become aware that he can do it. The Americans want him because he penetrated one of theirs in prison. The Brits cut a deal with a certain blonde-haired inhabitant of the White House, that we will, instead of putting him in prison, we'll turn him round and point him at our enemies. And so the blonde-haired president agrees to go along with that, providing that he shares all the product. And so that's exactly what we do. We create a unit, put the boy on the payroll. He's 18, therefore he's an adult. Surround him by bodyguards and say, can you find out exactly what's inside the most secret databases of Iran? And he does it. And what we discover is frightening. And it's not so far from the truth, because you may know that America has just pulled out of the concordat that we had. Brits are still in it, to relax economic sanctions against Iran if they will stop researching the acquisition of a nuclear bomb. Well, they haven't. That's the point. But if you can prove that, then you can do
extraordinary amount of things to a hostile regime. I identify three in the world. One is Russia, one is Iran, and one is North Korea.
So, Freddie, does this mean that you've had to become a cyber expert in order to write your latest?
No, I have not. I'm two generations before cyber space technology was invented, and it baffles me the hell. I don't understand it. So I had to go to some seriously, into that sort of science geeks and listen to them and beg them to say what they were saying in layman's English rather than their own cyber speak.
And where did you find these science geeks? Anywhere near Cheltenham?
There are some mentions in this book of a certain doughnut-shaped building. And the people who come from it, but there's a sort of off-spin of GCHQ in London now called
National
Cyber Security Centre in Victoria, and it's actually an ace of theirs who takes over, becomes a sort of pro tem father of this rather strange boy, Luke, and guides him and sets him his tasks, and watches. Astounded as he just goes straight through all the firewalls that surround the databases of the world. And there are mentions of real people, real institutions, certainly GCHQ was mentioned as MI6, obviously. What I'm trying to do here is, how shall I put it, look into the future if possible. Now, normally my stuff is set about 7 or 8 years back. Then I can check on what happened, what didn't happen. It's usually provable. This one, I'm afraid, is set in 2019. And as I was writing it, I kept reading my headline and saying, will you please slow down? You're doing all the things I'm writing about. So, including the Skripal business, which is still with us. We're now discovering, almost day after day, the real identities of the thugs who came in to do that job back in March. So I got almost overtaken by events, but not quite.
Yeah, fact stranger than fiction. So your dangerous weapon is called Luke, and by coincidence, I'm thinking, your dangerous weapon,
Luke
or certainly
Carlton,
the protagonist, is Luke Carlton. Tell us, it's his second trip out, isn't it?
Yeah, first of all, I must say, like probably lots of us, I grew up reading The Odessa File, Fourth Protocol, Day of the Jackal. I never in my wildest dreams thought that I would be sharing a stage here with the man who wrote these amazing books. So it's, I feel very kind of, I'm a little bit starstruck, actually. Of course, by you too, Julia. and the other thing I'll just say is that my dad died years ago, but I came across a photograph of him being presented with the Cheltenham Gold Cup in 1946, not for riding, not for racing, but for piano composition. He was still in uniform. He hadn't yet been demobbed. 1946, piano. Anyhow, completely irrelevant. second book, yeah. I mean, it's... Freddie probably doesn't even remember writing his second book, but for me, it's painfully fresh, and it's terrifying because you feel, okay, the first one, whew, you've got that done. Second bookitis, second albumitis, the risk of it being a disappointment after the first one is so big in your mind. So I really, really researched it hard. I went to Armenia by myself to a remote monastery up in a gorge so that I could see and feel exactly what one of the scenes would be like where I wanted a particularly bloodthirsty scene to happen in Ultimatum. To make it real. And in crisis, I've obviously been to Colombia several times. I was back there in July. And I think it's very important to actually know these places so that you can really bring them alive and paint them as they are for the reader.
So where are we? We're in the Gulf, aren't we? We're over that side of things. Just set the premise for us.
Sure. So Ultimatum is Luke Carlton's second mission, and it's about Iran. And the way it works, I'm told, in secret intelligence with SIS, is that they divide people's roles up. There are many different roles, but there are agent runners, which is the sharp end. There are reports officers, and there are targeters. And the targeters will say, right, we've got this instruction from Cabinet Office. We need to find out more, for example, about Iran's nuclear industry. So they will find somebody who might be a good person to recruit, who will have the information that they want. And they then have to get the agent runner in front of them. And this can take months, even years. Once that person is recruited, and often pitches will fail, so once that person's recruited, then they'll start providing information, raw intelligence, which is sent back to the reports officer who looks at it, and it's their job to say, this doesn't stack up, send it back, I need more information. Because even today, 15 years after the debacle of the Iraq-US, the British-US invasion of Iraq, SAS, I think, is still living under the shadow of the massive balls-up that was made over the dodgy dossiers and the intelligence failure. And what that was a failure not so much of collection, but of analysis, that what was coming out of Iraq was clearly far too weak to base anything on. It should never have even reached Cabinet Office. But there was so much political pressure. We know all of this. But the point is that they did a root and branch revamp of the way they work. I'm told, I mean, I only know this because when Spectre came out, I persuaded MI6, SIS, I said, is there any chance we could interview two of your serving operatives? And the answer came back, no. And then weeks later, they eventually relented and said, okay. And we got very little out of them, but they did at least tell me what I've just told you.
How happy are they to talk to you on a daily basis, given that you've got this brief of security correspondent, but you're also writing fiction? Is it who do you talk to? Is it friends that you've made along the way, or do you PR office? How does it work?
Right, there are three main intelligence agencies in this country: MI6, formerly known as Secret Intelligence Service. Their job is to steal secrets abroad, but obviously they work very closely with the other agencies, which is MI5. That's the security service. Their job is to try and stop plots. Terrorist plots in this country, which are not necessarily jihadist. It can be far-right extremists and IRA, real IRA, whoever. And then there is GCHQ, which, where are they?
Hands up.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be right at the back in the shadows. And we have sort of varying, we have an entirely working relationship with all of them. They've all been very professional with us. None of them have ever said, by the way, is there any chance you could sort of find this or that out for us? They've never done that. Probably they don't need to. They probably just tap into our phones or something. But good luck to them on that. But we have a pretty good working relationship with the security service, MI5, in the sense of when something happens, we can ring them up and we say, look, could you tell us a little bit about this person who's been arrested? And they'll tell us very, very little, but we'll throw things at them saying, now, is it true that this is to do with Birmingham, or is this connected with such and such? And they'll give us just enough that doesn't interfere with anything operationally, but enough to make sure that we're not talking absolute nonsense on air. They don't feed us any information. We have to get it out of them. MI6, we've kind of lost contact with Planet Vauxhall Cross. That we've not been in there for over 2 years. They've stopped having a media operation. They're just not interested. I think it's Alex Younger, who's the boss there, doesn't seem to be interested in the media. Well, fine, he's got other priorities. GCHQ have totally come of age. They are very much forward-leaning now because they are so active in terms of trying to keep Britain safe from plots. And, you know, whether that's trying to find out where Jihadi John is actually, where he is, which car he's getting into, whether there are civilians in it or whatever. And it's a very high-tech, complex thing. If you go into the operations room there, some of you may have been here, it's pretty impressive. This is exactly what Freddie was talking about. You know, it's the new era of spying. You know, everybody's got a digital footprint, and my goodness, these people, you know, they know how to get through 7 layers of encryption that jihadis might have or other would-be terrorists have got. Mm.
So there is that technology, but Freddie, in terms of how you get your information, is it still very much about human-to-human links and trust?
In my case, yes, because I don't understand the technology. In any case, I come from a different era. I mean, this young man is well young enough to be my son. My age was the Cold War. and that was basically the Berlin blockade of 1948, although it had begun, Stalin had begun it by 1945, when I was a ripe old age of seven. But by the Berlin blockade, I was 9 and a half, and onwards for 43 years, until basically Mikhail Gorbachev ended it, we thought, about 1991, when he dissolved the USSR, dissolved, abolished world communism, broke up the KGB, which had been, you know, the main enemy and opposition during my lifetime. By then, I was already middle-aged. So I go back to those days. And those days, yes, the contact was very personal. Most message on passing was personal. It was the brush pass or the dead letterbox. DLB, you don't have DLBs anymore. The hole in the tree, the loose brick in the wall. Memory lane. Nowadays, it's all electronic. It's cyberspace, and I don't understand cyberspace. But the thing is about the British establishment, it's infuriating in many ways and quite impressive in other ways. And one of the ways it's quite impressive is that everybody knows everybody. Almost everybody knows everybody. And it's never quite died. It should have died, but it never quite died. The concept of being a good egg, one of us, you know, a chap. Good family, good school.
And is it mostly chaps?
Well, so was Philby. So was Burgess. So was Maclean. They were trusted because they were one of us, chaps. It still goes on. To quote, I know a chap. I'll have a quiet word. It'll get you through barriers of cyberspace because you know the right chap to have a talk to. And I just go have him around the Special Forces Club for a drink at the bar and have a quiet chat. And that's what I do. I still do.
And it seems
to work.
And have you ever had the tap on the shoulder?
In what sense? Arrest?
Well, yeah, that too.
Yeah, I was nicked by the Stasi in East Germany, but not by our lot.
No, so have they ever asked you to do things that weren't either journalistic or novelistic, but to feed back?
Yes, I can say yes, because it's in the book I wrote called The Outsider. One thing that a lot of British taxpayers don't realise is that we've had a very, very good foreign intelligence service in this country for many, many years at an extraordinary bargain rate, paying you, taxpayers, paying less for it, because it's smaller in staff and smaller in budget than most of its competitors. And one of the reasons for that is the amount of what you might call free contribution made by people who aren't spies at all. An obvious example is in the old days of the Cold War, if a businessman was going to a very difficult to get at communist city on a trade mission, he had beautiful cover. The best cover of all is the true cover. So yes, Mr. Farnes Barnes is going to Sofia, Bulgaria, to sell his widgets. And so he's asked for a quiet lunch in a nice restaurant in the West End, and it's put to him that if he would be kind enough to just keep an eye open and ears open, be on the lookout, B-O-L-O, BOLO. Or even a little more, if an envelope came under your door in your hotel in the middle of the night, would you be terribly, terribly kind to bring it back? to that end, we will let you have this extremely technical attaché case, which has a secret compartment that nobody will ever find. Or at least if they do, you'll be doing 10 years in a Siberian log camp. But nevertheless, the answer often was, yeah, all right. Not for money, for the old country. The French could never get their businessmen to do that, nor could the Americans. For the Americans, it was money. For the French, it was no. the Brits, oh, I suppose so. Why not, old boy? We're one of us, aren't we? So, yes, I've done a few errands, I call them, in and out.
Have you ever been tempted, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, I've made no secret of it, but back when I was at university, I did Arabic at university at Exeter, and part of that was to be away for a year in Cairo. And there was this very charismatic diplomat at the embassy there, and myself and one of the other undergraduates said, is there any chance we could We could meet the MI6 station chief out here. It'd be quite fun to meet him. I don't think that'd be possible. He was the MI6 station chief. He just was very good at keeping his cover. And I didn't discover this till right at the end of our time in Cairo. And he took me to kind of, he got me to take him around the kind of the souk, Khan al-Khalili, and, you know, he was watching to see how I interacted with people. And when we left Cairo, he said, would you be interested when you're back in UK to go for an interview with MI6? I said, yeah, absolutely. And I went along to this interview. It was somewhere in SW1. Lovely building, Georgian building. And this, in every sense of the word, grey man sat behind a desk and said, right, you have to understand that if you are lucky enough to work for this organisation, you won't be able to tell anybody about it other than, you know, your wife. There was no question of sort of partner in those days. It was wife. You will appear to be a mid-career failure. You won't get any public recognition for your successes. But the rewards, it's, you know, nah. You know what? You've lost me at all of that. And there I am in television. So, you know, I think, and I know a lot of people think, ah, you know, public school, speaks Arabic, yeah, come on, former banker, he's bound to be a spook. I'd have made a rubbish spook because I want to tell, you know, like Freddie, I'm a storyteller. You want to tell people stories. That isn't really compatible with keeping secrets on the whole. So no, I flagged it away. And I've, you know, I can put my hand on my heart, and I have never, ever worked for any of the spooks and never been, since then, never been approached by them. They've never once said, you know, would you sort of mind... I never had the sort of the invitation to receive an envelope under the door. I've never had any of that.
Some good lunches, I tell you.
I probably did, yeah.
So we've talked a lot about chaps. Frank, when you're talking to people, your sources now, how mixed in gender terms are they?
Well, it's not as mixed as the bodyguard would have you believe, that's for sure. That is complete fantasy, I'm afraid. I mean, there are no female explosive ordnance officers at the moment in the bomb squad. Nice idea. But that said, I meet some incredibly talented, driven, professional women in the whole security and intelligence area who are really impressive, in many ways actually more impressive than the men. I'm not just saying that to be politically correct.
They,
it's true.
They lie better.
Yeah, maybe. Well, yeah, but they're just really good at their jobs. And I'm not talking so much about the kind of sharp military end of carrying a Bergen and humping it over Dartmoor or whatever or elsewhere, but in terms of modern intelligence gathering and security work, particularly MI5, probably some of the most impressive people that we meet there are women. There's no question about it. They're skillful linguists. A lot of it is about persuading people to do things that they don't want to do. That's essentially what an agent runner does, is persuading somebody to betray their organization or their country, which is what the first chapter in Ultimatum is about, where it kind of goes horribly wrong for Luke Carlton. In that sense, it's pretty real. In both these books, I've interviewed a lot of people, mostly who have recently left, but they've always signed the Official Secrets Act, so there's a limit to how much they can tell me. I haven't signed it, so I'm not bound by the same constrictions. But to understand how a hostage rescue team would insert covertly into Iranian territorial waters at night, I needed to talk to a lot of people to find out how that would be done. So that scene in the book is, I think, probably pretty true to life.
When The Day of the Jackal came out, there was some suggestion that actually it was a pretty good assassin's manual.
It was all right.
There was some suggestion that The Day of the Jackal was quite a good assassin's manual, a kind of how-to.
Yeah.
Was that a concern?
I didn't think it was fair, because, in fact, to my recall, the only statesman who's ever been assassinated with a rifle was Kennedy, and that was 10 years before. I wrote it was 1963, I believe. So 10 years before... The Day of the Jackal. Ever since then, there have been numerous assassinations. Two Indian prime ministers, a Swede called Olof Palme, and various others around the globe, and including an Israeli, but always at point-blank range by an assassin who then either was captured or died. So the long-range sniper as an assassin of presidents, I don't think really was a manual, because it's never been done, and it would have been, I think, you know, copied if it had been workable. But the one that was, of my stuff, that was used as a manual was The Dogs of War. Mm. Now, this is about a group of mercenaries who actually topple. They don't just attack an African republic. They actually topple the president and his government and impose a new one. I was rather amused later to be told by a friend of Bob Dinard, the French mercenary, that when he and his gang invaded and toppled the government of the Comoros Islands on behalf of the French government in Paris, they were running up the beach with the copy of Les Chiens de Guerre in the back pocket. kept flicking over to see what they're supposed to do next. I never got invited to the Comoros Islands.
My thanks to Julia Wheeler, Frederick Forsyth and Frank Gardner. For a list of the wide range of thrillers written by both writers, check out the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now it's back to Stella Rimington for the books of her life. So, Stella, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become a writer?
Yes, I suppose the book that springs to mind in that category is Swallows and Amazons, which I remember reading, I suppose, I don't know how old I was, probably about nine or something, but particularly loved it because it was about the Lake District, where we used to go, cause when we lived in Barrow and Furness in the war, we used to go up to the Lake District to walk, and so, adventures on one of the lakes really spoke to me, and the idea of children going off and having adventures anyway was something I rather liked. So, yep, it was Swallows and Amazons.
At last, when almost everything was piled in the boathouse, just before it was time for Roger and Titty to go to bed, the whole crew went up the path into the pine wood, to the peak of Darien to look once more at the island. The sun was sinking over the western hills. There was a dead calm. Far away they saw the island and the still lake without a ripple on it stretching away into the distance. "I can't believe we're really going to land on it," said Titty. "We aren't unless there's wind tomorrow," said Captain John. "We'll have to whistle for a wind." Titty and Roger, by agreement, whistled one tune after another all the way home. As they came to the farm, the leaves of the beech trees shivered overhead. "You see," said Titty, "we got some wind. Wake up early and we'll go out and do some more whistling before breakfast."
Swallows and Amazons by Arthur Ransom is available in Braille, giant print and as TB2558, which is narrated by Gabriel Wolfe. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I think it would be Cold Comfort Farm by Stella Gibbons, which appeals to my rather quirky sense of humour. And that's a book that was introduced to me by my mother, as far as I remember. And I've enjoyed reading it over and over again. So, yes, that's what I would read on a rainy day to make myself laugh.
"Now I must be off and see to my other gentleman's dinner," said Mrs. Murtha, having hovered long enough to see that Flora had all the salt and pepper, bread, forks and the rest of it that she wanted. "Have you another gentleman?" asked Flora. "Yes, staying here. A book writer," rejoined Mrs. Murtha. "He would be," muttered Flora. "What's his name?" for she wondered if she knew him. "Maybug," was the improbable answer. Flora simply did not believe this, but she was too busy eating to start a long and exhausting argument. She decided that Mr. Maybug must be a genius. A person who was merely talented would have weakly changed his name by deed poll. What a bore it was, she thought. Had she not enough to do at Cold Comfort without there being a genius named Maybug staying a mile away from the farm who would probably fall in love with her? For she knew from experience that intellectuals and geniuses seldom fall for females of their own kidney who had gone all queer about the shoes and coiffure. but concentrated upon reserved but normal and properly dressed persons like herself, who were both repelled and alarmed, not to say bored, by the purposeful advances of the said geniuses and intellectuals.
Stella Gibbons's Cold Comfort Farm is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB1714, narrated by Elizabeth Proud. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the RNIB Connect Radio listeners?
Well, there is a book that I'm reading currently as part of the research for the book I'm writing. And that is a book by a former KGB general called Oleg Kalugin. And I don't suppose you've got this in your library at all. It's called Spymaster, My 32 Years, I think it is, My 32 Years in Intelligence and Espionage Against the West. And it is the biography of Oleg Kalugin, whom I know because he's on the board of the International Spy Museum in Washington, as am I. And he is a KGB general who left the KGB and went to live in America. And this book describes how the Cold War came to an end, really, and how the KGB, in a sense, disintegrated, only, of course, to reform later. So anybody who's interested in the end of the Cold War or in intelligence from the inside would love this book, I think. It's very well written.
Spymaster by Oleg Kalugin is out now commercially. Dame Stella Rimmington, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.